This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, it's been a while since we have had a chance to check in with Jeff Strack, who is officially the president and CEO of Indiana Grocery Group, which is based in Highland. And, of course, it's best known as being the owner and operator of the Strack and Van Til supermarkets here in Northwest Indiana. And, Jeff, thank you very much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, my pleasure. Glad to catch up again.
Yeah, it's been a while since we talked. The last time, actually, we had a conversation. It was about at the point when you and your colleagues creating the new Indiana Grocery Group had about to take over the Strack and Van Til supermarkets operations from what at the time was Central Grocers. Of course, that is an organization over in Illinois that went bankrupt. That's what prompted all of the shutdowns of the supermarkets, most of them Ultra supermarkets and other related stores here in Northwest Indiana. And you've been able to pick things back up and rebuild the business almost not quite from the ground up, but pretty close from it, hasn't it been?
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey, though. It's hard to believe it's already been 2 years this August when we officially took over the 20 stores that we purchased out of the bankruptcy court. But a lot has gone on. In some ways, it seems like it was just yesterday, but in many cases, it seems a whole lifetime ago. And we've spent a lot of time rebuilding a business. And it's kind of a unique situation buying a company, an existing company out of bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. Parts of it are existing, but there's a whole bunch of new things that go on that are relatively new. You have to reestablish and start over from scratch on a lot of things. And, you know, some things we had some surprising things along the way and some things not so surprising. But we've really focused here in the last close to 2 years on rebuilding our foundation and our culture here and getting our store operations and our merchandising back to what our customers in Northwest Indiana expect from a Strack and Van Til store.
When you folks took on the matter of deciding to pick things up after Central Grocers went bankrupt, what was probably the most challenging point that you had to first address before you could get Strack and Van Til back and back before everybody is the company that they always knew it as?
I think it's just reestablishing the culture identity and who we were. I mean, going through the traumatic events of closing stores, having to lay off people, going into bankruptcy, we still think about the amount of people that no longer work with us and having to get over that hurdle that we are a new company and looking at things a little bit differently and more importantly, motivating them. This is a new day here for Strack and Van Til and a new opportunity for us to get back to doing business the way we used to and knew how the customers of Northwest Indiana, what they expected from us as a grocery store and really, just had to really encourage, and it was a lot of hard work and getting the people right in the stores, getting, like as I mentioned earlier, our merchandising and our operations in our stores back to the level that people expected. And that was, you know, it's not easy. It seems like it might be easy. You just don't go and sprinkle any of this pixie dust over it, and all of a sudden it magically happens. It's day in, day out, reinforcing the expectations and the standards that we have here at Strack and Van Til.
Did you find that getting back to the family concept from it being a corporate, basically a corporately owned operation, seemed to be one of the big challenges or the biggest challenge as well?
I think it was actually being back in control of a more privately owned company has had its advantages. It's allowed us to move much quicker in areas instead of waiting for approvals and having to convince a group of other outsiders on what we wanted to do. And now it's much simpler, much, much more efficient, and we're able to maneuver and act much quicker. And I think that's been a benefit, not having to deal with a larger company that may have different objectives and goals than what we have here at Strack. So we're all on the same page now, rowing the same direction, and that's been a nice thing.
I imagine probably for those people, the old shoppers, the ones who remember even going back to just the Strack stores, and of course the Van Til store that's still around in Hammond, it's probably very, very comforting to them to know that it's getting back to the business that they grew up with and they came to expect, and they probably don't miss the corporate issues at all, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think, you know, probably the corporate issues were more internal than external, but there's certainly, even now, 2 years later, it's always surprising to me the amount of people that come up to me and some of our other leaders and say thank you doing what we did, taking the company back under the Strack and the Van Til families, and how much that means to them, and more importantly to the community. I have a lot of people in the community that say, you know, they don't know what would have happened to a lot of the organizations and events that we help support, sponsor, and guide along the way. And I think people realize that the importance of having a locally owned company is a big deal for any community. And as we like to say, you know, a lot of people use the word local, but we are Indiana made, and we're here right here in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, I just realized that there are a lot of organizations here in Northwest Indiana that maybe don't realize it until, unfortunately, it was scary at the time, that the Strack and Van Til had been such a great supporter of the community with all kinds of events and supportive organizations. So it's nice to have that reassuring support back again. Let's take a look a little bit first here at the organization, and we'll get into some of the new things that Strack and Van Til is involved with. What kinds of changes, aside from having to trim the roster, so to speak, of supermarkets, did Strack and Van Til have to do to be able to get back on their feet?
Well, the first thing that we had to accomplish was make our transition to our new wholesaler in AWG, and that was a timely process. From the day we closed, it probably took a good 6 to 7 months to complete that transition in an orderly fashion. And it was a pretty difficult time going from Central Grocers to another supplier to eventually AWG. And that created some internal and external, you know, frustration among our people, our stockers, with different items coming and going, and more importantly, our customers. And that took some time to fully transition. And then we had a certain period of time after that where we had to go back and really work on making sure our offerings in our stores were at the level that we once had through this transition. Many other things that we've continued to work on since then is, you know, from a technology standpoint, we really wanted to get back to focusing in on how we can make things more efficient for our customers and for our people on our staff, and really get into the online shopping component, which is been becoming a much larger deal in not only the grocery industry, but just in retail in general.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit here about what Strack and Van Til stores can do online these days. And also, too, there's opportunities that people have to use their smartphones, their apps and their phones to be able to get your orders together and be ready to pick up at the stores, too. Fill us in on all of the new tech items that have happened since you all took over.
Well, shortly after we took over, we were able to do institute a click and we had the click and collect, where customers could order online and pick up at the store, and then we added the delivery component to it. So customers no longer have to leave their house to come to Strack and Van Til to get their groceries. They can order everything wherever they're at, whether on their phone or on their desktop, and have it delivered straight to their homes. And that part of our business has been grown exponentially over the last year, and I don't see that slowing down anytime in the near term. I think people really enjoy the convenience of not having to run out to pick up items at the grocery store on a regular basis, and they can use our online ordering as a way to save them some time and get back to a better work-life balance in their own personal life.
Yeah, we know that Northwest Indiana winters can be brutal, and there are probably a lot of people, and certainly know older folks that have trouble getting out and around when the weather gets bad, and so they obviously can appreciate being able to use these new techniques to get the orders together and get their groceries delivered, to be sure. What do the customers think these days about not only the new tech things that we've just talked about, but just about all of the improvements that have been made with the Strack and Van Til supermarkets since the changeover?
Well, from what we hear from our customers and our associates, it's been very favorably received, and business continues to exceed our projections, and we're extremely happy for that, and very appreciative of our team. You know, everybody here, of nearly 2,800 employees that we have worked real hard the last 2 years to make sure that we got out of the gate strong as a new company, and everybody's job here is important at Strack and Van Til, and I'm just so appreciative that everyone comes to work and really puts in a strong effort to really make sure that our customers are happy to be Strack and Van Til customers.
Now, Jeff Strack, well, how do things look for the future for the Indiana Groceries Group, and in particular for the Strack and Van Til supermarkets?
I think our future is bright. We're, you know, working on a lot of things. Right now, we've recently instituted our rewards program to reward our customers with extra savings and deals through another app, and we continue to look for ways to make people's lives easier. And in fact, we wrote our vision statement, and it's pretty simple. It's to make people's lives easier. And a lot of times people think of from the customer standpoint, but we're also focusing on how do we make our employees' lives easier and what are things that we can do to make their jobs more enjoyable, make them make Sacramento a fun place mm-hmm. to come to work. And those are things that we're doing and just continue to focus on being the neighborhood grocer here in Northwest Indiana.
It's tough these days, I'm sure. Still tough, maybe I should say. It hasn't gotten much easier, I suppose, with the business atmosphere as it is, and not only here in Northwest Indiana, but around the country as well, in trying to deal with the competition, and it's still out there, that places like Strack and Van Til has to deal with. What is your assessment here, in the few minutes we have left, to talk about how the atmosphere of business, especially for the supermarket business, is shaping up these days?
I think the supermarket industry and retail in general is just going through a big transformation. You know, the online component is really making retailers refocus on what space they need to be in and really what makes your company special and relevant to the customer. And I think when you look at the grocery industry in particular, there's so many more places now to get things that typically used to be bought in a grocery store, whether it's online or at a dollar store or a big box store. It's no longer just your typical competitor of a traditional grocery store. And there's a lot of what we call channel blurring going on, where people are just spending their money in a host of other areas than where they used to primarily spending it in a grocery store. And that even extends to restaurants and other food outlets mm-hmm. where people are eating out more instead of cooking at home. And that all has an effect on our industry, but that also is where we have to continue to work hard to find new innovations to make sure that our customers realize that we're still relevant in their space. And we do that through different offerings in our stores. We've spent a lot of time looking at how we could have meal replacements for them, how different ways that we can make meal preparation easier, quicker, whether it's grab and go, assembling items for their dinner or snacking needs throughout the day. So always business, whether it's grocery or anywhere else, it's continually changing, and the successful ones are able to see it and adapt and make the necessary changes to remain relevant to the consumer.
Well, let's hope that success continues on for the years ahead for you and all your colleagues, Jeff. Jeff Strack is the president and CEO of Indiana Grocery Group, but you know the organization better as Strack and Van Til Supermarkets. Jeff, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Look forward to speaking with you again.
The Calumet region is made up of diverse communities, innovative industries, ecosystems that are very resilient, especially over the passage of time. And so now we're trying to piece all these things together to create an interesting situation that is called the Calumet Heritage Area. And for that, let's turn to the executive director of the Calumet Collaborative, Sarah Colder. Sarah, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
I'm glad to be here, Chris. Thank you for inviting me.
I'll take a few minutes, if you will, explain to listeners that may or may not be aware of it. Maybe they've been residents or they've been visitors, where the Calumet heritage really starts in, the region that it encompasses, and why it's now becoming so important. They really have to expand it further with this Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative.
The Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative has been almost a two-decades-long process in building support, getting people engaged, and it was really spearheaded by a nonprofit bi-state organization called the Calumet Heritage Partnership. They, along with their partners at the Field Museum, worked on creating a feasibility study, which is kind of the first step in actually becoming a designated heritage area. The feasibility study is required by the National Park Service to ensure that your idea for a nationally significant heritage area meets all their criteria. The Heritage Area Program actually started with the I&M Canal Heritage Area back in 1984, and that is along the I&M Canal in the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So the Calumet Heritage Partnership, along with the partners at the Field Museum, shepherded a feasibility study through the process at the National Park Service. When it came to determining how a all-volunteer nonprofit organization was going to coordinate an extensive and highly sophisticated heritage area as a National Park Service program, they really didn't have a whole lot of staff capacity or time available because they're an all-volunteer organization.
I see.
The Calumet Collaborative, which is who I work for, is also a bi-state nonprofit organization that works to pull together partners across state lines to work on nationally and regionally, most specifically regionally specific and significant projects. So being that the Heritage Partnership has spearheaded and shepherded it as far as they have, we have become partners with them to take it to that next level. So all of the partners and stakeholders that are part of the Advisory Council of the Calumet Collaborative have joined in with those partners at the Calumet Heritage Partnership to forward the Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative.
We talk about this Calumet Heritage Area. It's very big. We kind of alluded to it at the beginning of our conversation about geographically, at least. But it involves, I guess, among other things, two national parks. We know what the newest one of the two is, which, of course, is the new Indiana Dunes National Park. What's the second, the more established national park, so to speak, that's out there that's all part of this?
Yes. So we like to say that we are bookended by two National Park Service properties. The Pullman National Monument on the Illinois side and to the northwest, and the newly created or newly renamed Indiana Dunes National Park to the east. The Calumet Heritage Area is really kind of made up of both the Calumet watershed as well as the Calumet region work shed, story shed. So while it encompasses a very large portion of geography, it actually is meant to, because there's so many stories and significant events that have happened in this really vast region that can be attributed to the significance and the history and the knowledge and the innovation and the activism that all occurred in the Calumet region.
I understand, too, that a large part of what is encompassed in the area not only includes the national parks, in this case, the two bookends, as you referred to, but also about local parks and trails and how tourism fits in, too. Tell us how that would fit into it as the project goes through.
The Calumet Heritage Area isn't a specific place on a map. It's an entire landscape of a lived-in landscape. That's how we like to describe it. So all of the parks, all of the trails, all of the small businesses within this geography make a difference to the operation of this heritage area. Partner support is crucial in order to make it successful. So with each park, with each trail, with each small business, coffee shop, or restaurant, all working together, we can shine a light on this region that we believe, I believe, mm-hmm. is incredibly interesting, incredibly unique, and has so many stories to tell that we can not only learn from, but celebrate in the region.
Then you talk, too, about economic development. In particular, you talk about small businesses, coffee shops, whatever they may be. They're all very much a part of this mosaic that makes up the National Heritage Area. What kind of advantages would local businesses be able to get if this National Heritage Area comes to fruition?
Well, a lot of people think of tourism, right, as you have a place to visit, a place to go. And once you go there, you need to have drinks or coffees or beers or whatever for those people traveling there. But we're not necessarily thinking of just the outsiders coming into the region, but the intra-region use of all of the assets in the heritage area. So if you're traveling from Flossmoor to Gary, you'll be hopefully supporting small businesses in Gary. And likewise, if you're traveling from Crown Point to Pullman, you'll have the ability to support small businesses in the Pullman neighborhood. So that's where some of the economic development, or at least one portion of the economic development that we see as a result of the establishment of the heritage area. The second part of economic development we see as part of the heritage area initiative is by shining in the light and by increasing the pride of place for residents, and to have this kind of beginning economic development, it will show how many fantastic communities are located in the Calumet region and why people would want to live, work, or play there, and hopefully lift up these communities as livable communities and increase the tax base by having new residents, by retaining more residents, as well as hopefully by that time having large employers or small employers locate in the region because they want to be part of this, these strong, cohesive communities.
We're talking with Sarah Coulter. She's the executive director of the Calumet Collaborative, which is a bi-state organization that includes Indiana as well as Illinois. And one of the things in particular that I understand, Sarah, that's really underway now is the timetable for creating this national heritage area for the Calumet region. And I guess it's actually started in, I guess, late last year in 2018, but it's continuing on through much of this year, is it not?
Yes. We have established a coordinating committee with our partners in CHP, so Calumet Collaborative and CHP working together. And we've laid out five different areas that we need to work on together to forward the advancement of this initiative. The first one is programs. How do we establish good programs that will encourage people to come out and visit different sites in the region? Within our programming arm, we are working with the Field Museum and a number of local historical societies, galleries, and museums in the Calumet region to put together a traveling exhibit that will start this year in June 27th in the Pullman Visitor Center. And it's a collaboration between a number of different historical societies, galleries, and other historians putting together an exhibit that will highlight some of the stories of the region. That exhibit will then travel to Gary in December of 2019. After Gary, and it will be at the Gary Public Library. Mm-hmm. After the Gary Public Library, it will move to the Brower Museum at Valparaiso University, and then in 2020. And then in 2021, there will be a full 11-month exhibit at the Field Museum. So that's just the programming arm of what we've got going on this year.
Well, that's a lot. That's an awful lot when you think about it. And a very, very coordinated effort, too, because you have not only what's being done there with CHP, but also, too, it's got to get coordinated with all of the other partners that are involved in Gary, in Valparaiso, and in all the other communities that will be along the way.
Absolutely. Another initiative that we're working on is the advocacy portion. Yeah. And this is kind of the key part that is working to actually get the designation through Congress. And it's a little bit tricky, and there's a lot of politics and government speak in this process. But after we have received a letter from the National Park Service saying we've met all their criteria, the next step, and so that's pretty much the green light from the National Park Service. What that means then is that now it's up to Congress to actually designate the Calumet Heritage Area as a national heritage area. That's a little bit trickier. Congress is a little bit tough to work with sometimes, but what we've done is we've created some draft legislation. We've met with our bi-state congressional delegation of Congressman Dislosky and Congresswoman Kelly's office to talk about the draft legislation that we have come up with. And the next step would be to introduce it as a bill, from there to get that bill passed, and then from there to have funds allocated to the Calumet Heritage Area.
Well, it sounds like a lot of work, as you say, yet to be done here going into 2019 here. We just started in the year, just a few months in, a lot more that's going to continue on besides all of the great programs where residents and can keep track and learn more in particular about the Calumet heritage, what they see, what they don't see, what's there in the history books, as well as what they get to see in their own eyes, the nature as well. If there is any place that people want to go to find out more information, tell us more about the website that's been established to talk more about it.
Sure. Our website has been established for the Calumet Heritage Area, and the web address is just simply www.calumetheritagearea.org. From that website, you can find out more about our programs. You can find more about the process of becoming a heritage area. You can find out more about who's involved in the project. But more importantly, you will be able to sign up for a newsletter that will give you monthly updates on how we're doing on the other aspects of our work, the management planning, our communications rollout with our identity and branding project for the Heritage Area, as well as some projects that we hope to fundraise for and reach out to get additional partners involved in the work of establishing a heritage area.
We've been talking with Sarah Coulter. She's the executive director of Calumet Collaborative about the Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative. Saturday and Sunday, June 29th and June 30th, is the free art festival is established in the community of Valparaiso, the Valparaiso Art Festival. And to tell us more about it, we have the president of the producer of the event, Amy Amdur, is with us. Amy, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
Well, you as should be. It's of course, this is old hand to you guys. You establish a number of art festivals around the country and in the region as well, too. I think the Gold Coast Art Fair is yours. Chicago Botanic Garden Art Festival is one of yours as well, too. What do you see that in establishing this in Valparaiso is like the others, but not like the others?
Well, I can tell you, Valparaiso is a really wonderful, unique community. You know that. Everyone listening knows that. And the redevelopment of the downtown really set the stage for events in Valparaiso. And Valpo Events is doing a great job with all the things that they're creating. And I was in town a couple of years ago just to look around and to see what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I was so impressed. We started a discussion with Valparaiso that became a conversation, which became the foundation for this art festival that we're launching this coming weekend. So, having this great, kind of center heart of Valparaiso really makes a beautiful backdrop, and we're going to be opening up this Friday. We're going to set in, and then Saturday and Sunday we're open from 10 to 5 both days. Free admission, as you said, and we're piggybacking on the farmers market, so that's going to be happening. And the art festival will be on Indiana and Lafayette, and you're going to see artists from about 10 different states all coming in. And, of course, there are going to be some artists from Valparaiso as well. So we're really excited to have that local component of not only some adult artists like Dave Lee and Jackie Gray, who are from the area. Dave is a glass artist, and Jackie does these beautiful purses that each one is a unique creation. But then we also have some of the area youth in our area youth division. That's for kids who are between the ages of 6 and 18. So you're going to see people you know, and you'll also be meeting a lot of artists who are coming in from all corners of the United States. We're really excited.
I took a look at the Valparaiso Events website, and there's some great pictures there, too. If you haven't had a chance to check them out, do so. You'll get to see some of the great samples of what some of the artists and artisans are going to be presenting at the art festival this weekend. You mentioned that you came into Valparaiso a couple years ago kind of just to look over the place and see what you thought might be good and bad, things to deal with, especially that you could be able to turn into the best location for an art festival. How long has it taken to get this year's very first art festival going?
Well, yeah, it really has taken 2 years of working, locally, with the community and with Valpo Events. And then there's a lot of work that goes into the art festival. And it's not that the public has to know, but there are a lot of details. And so last year, we did something called a call for artists. We did a national call for artists where we invited people to apply to this show. And the application process consists of each artist who wants to do the show sending in 4 images of their work and 1 of what their display would look like. Then we assembled a group of art professionals who scored each entry, and then we invited in the top artist with the top scores. So that's called a juried art festival. And what the requirement is that each artist be at the show and that they are the maker of the art that they're presenting. This way, the public gets a chance to meet the artist, to find out about the art process, what the artist was thinking, what their motivation was. I kind of call it a soft educational event. You can learn something without it being, a kind of tedious situation. And we're going to have artists demonstrating as well. So you'll see artists painting, and you'll see them drawing, and you'll see them creating their mixed media pieces on site. And we have some people who will be describing their process as well. We have Joel Piskowitz. He's from Porter, not too far away. He's a ceramic artist. He's going to be explaining his process. And, it's a fun event and something that multi-generational groups can come to. Come with the grandparents, come with the grandchildren. Adults will enjoy this. And we certainly want children to come. And they're totally welcome at this show. In fact, we have a youth art tent where kids are invited to make art projects, and we'll have all the materials for them, and everyone can get creative. We also are going to have these big graffiti walls, and we'll be supplying chalk so you can create your drawings and anything that you feel inspired to make on these graffiti walls. So we'll have some fun interactive components to the festival as well. And for those people who like music, we have live music the entire weekend on the stage.
I want to ask you in more detail about that. We should mention, too, by the way, that this year's Valparaiso Art Festival is kicking off, as you say, Friday with the first events, and then all day Saturday and Sunday the 30th as well. It's going to be in Central Park Plaza, so that puts it down there at Lafayette Street and Indiana Avenue, right in downtown Valparaiso, and right in, I think, almost the center of the Good Eats area, isn't it?
Well, you're right. So, there's so many great choices. And I say, come for the art and stay for the food. There are some great restaurants in the area. And you also, if you want to just get a bite on the street, we have Uncle Menny's with the original Greek pizza coming to the festival as well. And, there are a lot of food choices. And the farmer's market, is going to be going on at the same time. So you can kind of just walk between the two festivals, and no one should be hungry that weekend, I can tell you, because there are going to be so many choices.
I would say it would be wise to come hungry, and this way you'll get filled up pretty fast, to be sure.
Absolutely, and this is a handicap accessible event, wheel friendly, so whether it's a stroller, wheelchair, or a scooter, everybody is invited to come out and enjoy. The only thing we need is good weather, but we are a rain or shine event, so whatever the case, everybody comes. But I think the weather forecast looks like it's hopefully going to be, nice and finally giving us some good summer weather. I think we all deserve that.
Yes,
for sure. In addition to, some of the artists I mentioned, we also, in case people want to know, there are going to be a lot of painters showing their work, everything from traditional landscapes to contemporary pieces. We have a guy nationally acclaimed, Ken Orton, who comes in. You would swear these are photographs, but when you look closely, you will see they are impeccable paintings, so we call him a photorealist.
Ah.
I think everybody's going to want to come see him. And then we have abstract artists. We have amazing photographers. For those people who like to wear their art, we have people who are jewelry makers, and you'll be seeing their works at all different prices. And we have wearables and mixed media and sculptors. So there's definitely going to be something for everybody. And to keep the kids busy while the adults are looking at the art, we've created something called Art Fest Bingo. And these are free bingo cards that we give out. And the kids will be looking for, instead of B5, it will be looking for a painting of a sunset or a photograph of an animal. And seriously, I created this when my own children were young. But it keeps the kids busy and looking, and it makes it fun when the children are happy. The parents are happy, so we want everyone to come and just have a great time and talk with the artists and enjoy the experience. We're looking at this as an annual ongoing event. This is the first event, but we are looking to lay the foundation for many, many years to come of bringing art to Valparaiso and giving the young people, in addition, a chance to be in the youth division of the festival.
Now, Amy, if anybody would like more information, like to have a chance to look at the samples that you've offered up here and let people know more about this weekend's Valparaiso Art Festival, how can they find out?
Well, our website is full of information, and the website is amderproductions.com. So that's A-M like mother, D like David, U-R, then the word productions with an S.com. And there's a lot of info on Valparaiso Art Festival right there, not only where it is, but some of the things that you'll find to do there and the music and you know, my recommendations are wear comfortable shoes, put mm-hmm. the sunscreen on before you leave the house, and just come have a good time.
Well, Amy, thanks for spending time with us to tell us more about this very first Valparaiso Art Festival coming up this weekend in downtown Valparaiso, and we appreciate you having a chance to tell us more today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the time. Hope everyone comes by and has a chance to enjoy the festival. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Amy Amdur is the president of Amdur Productions and producer of this very first Valparaiso Art Festival this weekend. Coming up on July 13th, to be held in the town of Highland, is going to be the very first annual Northwest Indiana Pride event. It's being billed as a one-day, family-friendly, LGBTQ+ supportive festival. And the organizations that are putting all this together include the LGBTQ Northwest Indiana and PFLAG Crown Point and Pride Events Incorporated organizations. And we have with us the two people that are organizing and running both of these organizations, as well as the big event coming up this summer. Amari Victoria is the executive director of LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, and Elizabeth Manning is the president of PFLAG Crown Point, which is a support group organization. We'll find out more about that shortly. And also with the Pride Events Incorporated, which is an organization you all set up to help get the Pride event underway. Thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay. Well, first, Amari, if you will, tell us the involvement that you have, a personal as well as, I guess, in a way, a support group and professional feeling that you have about helping organize not only what you've done for the group that you helped support, LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, but also the idea of having the very first Northwest Indiana Pride.
Thank you, Chris. My organization, LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, was formed after I discovered that there was really no support in Northwest Indiana for transgender folks like myself. And I decided that I needed to have support that was local, more local than a two-hour car ride mm-hmm. away from our hometown of Crown Point. So I formed LGBTQ Northwest Indiana and started a transgender support group, as well as a discussion group for parents and guardians of transgender children. Those have been going on for almost a year now on a monthly basis. And that the fact that there was no support here also meant that there were no services that I could find.
Elizabeth, how do you fit into the picture now?
So I'm Amari's spouse, and we got married before she discovered she was transgender. Once she discovered that, of course, I was going to stick by her side and go through the journey with her. As we were looking for support, as she mentioned, there were no places in Northwest Indiana. We were traveling to Goshen or to Michigan City. They have a great PFLAG chapter there, and found them very inspirational as well as helpful. So I turned to her one day and said, you know, I want to start a transgender support group in our area. And she said, no, you can't. Mm-hmm. I said, why? She said, because I'm going to. So she did. And then I started a PFLAG chapter, which is designed to support the families, friends, allies, and members of the LGBTQ community.
I guess, and PFLAG has been around, it's national, of course, and it's been around here in the region for some time, at least in other states. Besides the fact that there was no local chapter, what prompted you to decide to get PFLAG going here in the region?
Well, there are not many spouses that stay with people once those people come out as transgender, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of confusion about, especially among parents who have children, and it is crucial to be accepted by family and friends and schoolmates and teachers, because if kids aren't supported, there is just such a terrible suicide rate. And just to be able to help people understand what the LGBTQ world is and be able to accept everybody as equal individuals, I think it's become a burning passion of mine, as it is Amari's.
Let's talk about LGBTQ Northwest Indiana and getting that organization started. What does it offer to residents here in the area that are interested, are inquisitive, but want to get involved?
Well, besides the support groups, which are already established, mm-hmm. I feel that education is extremely important, not only for people within the LGBTQ community, but the community at large. So I have been co-hosts or presented various educational topics. Suicide prevention workshops were performed with in conjunction with Geminis Regional Health Systems and my doctor, who is located in Goshen, Indiana, has been out here in Northwest Indiana to present two different health-related topics, one about hormone replacement therapy for transgender people and another about sensitivity and awareness for the medical profession and healing arts professions.
I know that your intent is to be able to bring to the general public a view of what the LGBTQ community is here in Northwest Indiana. It's education as well as entertainment, I guess you could say. Let's talk a little bit first of what's going to be planned here for the very first annual Northwest Indiana Pride event in Highland this summer. And where does first the educational aspect come in?
Well, the educational aspect would come in that we have a variety of vendors who will be at the event that will be promoting their services in Northwest Indiana, some of them general for the general public, but most of them also focusing on the LGBTQ community. Health services and mental health services are very important in the area for our community.
We're going to be offering free health screenings for people. As people come in, we're going to have some information about the gender spectrum, the gender identity, sexual orientation, and gender expression, the differences between that. So there'll be posters around and some displays and different booths handing out information so they can stop by and see all that.
Now, we've talked about education, and then, of course, we've mentioned entertainment. That probably comes in many facets. Tell us at least what's planned now for happening during the very first Northwest Indiana Pride when it comes to entertainment.
Okay, I'm going to tell you about our headliner musical act. That is the Brian Carmona Band. And he's just wonderful blues and rock, modern rock, classic rock. With a twist. He blends in a lot of R&B and soul with his music, and we're very happy to have him as our headlining musical act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have some drag shows lined up, both family-friendly during the day and then an adult drag show during the after party. Drag Kings are also going to be there. We've got another band. We'll have a Zumba class. We have a poetry reading or story reading, basically spoken word session. And we actually do have some weddings and vow renewals that'll be taking place,
oh, really?
As well as kids' entertainment.
That's great. Now, when you mentioned it's the point, I'm sure is going to bring people's attention right to what you mentioned about drag shows. And you told like a family-friendly drag show. That's interesting. How would you define that for somebody that is not aware of what that would be?
So a family-friendly drag show means that the language is proper, mm-hmm. and the displays are not risque, and the clothing is not risque. It'll be entertaining, you know, for the children. It'll be at a level where they can enjoy it. More of the kind of glam style or Vegas style type of drag show during the day.
Have you found in talking with people and as you're getting the event organized for the summer that maybe when you mentioned, well, this is what we have lined up, what we'd like to do, some of the events and the activities, you have music and you have the poetry readings, and now you mentioned that when you get to the other entertainment events too, people kind of give you a strange look as to what's this all about? Or do you think that maybe people in Northwest Indiana are becoming a bit more familiar of this?
Well, as far as drag shows are concerned, I believe that most people probably know what they are. Mm-hmm. RuPaul's Drag Race on TV probably helps that out a bit. I think the opinions of drag performers is mixed. But we hope to at least get across to the general public that drag shows are meant to be entertaining.
When you talk about some of the other things, you talk about a wide variety of genres of music and the like, and you talk about the poetry readings and all too, do you think that this is going to be a surprise to anybody that happens to attend the event in July?
I think some of it will be a surprise. The reactions we've been getting when talking to local businesses and individuals has been surprisingly and pleasingly positive. Mm-hmm. They're excited that this is coming to Northwest Indiana. We've got a great DJ lined up, too, who's going to help us coordinate all these performers and the music. Colorblind celebrations. And I think that it's just going to be a lot of fun for people.
You have mentioned about the fact that you do have a lot of support from organizations and from businesses and the like here in the region as you get things organized here. And you mentioned that you've gotten a lot of support, at least mentioned so far, in doing so. How much work would you say it has become since this is your very first event, although you've done other, I'm sure, fundraisers and the like. In fact, you had a fundraiser just not long ago, and you have more planned in advance of the Pride event coming up in July. But on a scale, we'll say, that ranges from putting on a bake sale to doing the Gary Ayer show, where do you think that, at least right now, what the NWI Pride seems to range on that scale?
I believe our estimate right now would hang a lot closer to the air show.
Especially personally.
It is unbelievable how many facets there are involved in putting together a show of this size, an event of this size.
Do you think that since you're doing a lot of this work yourself and doing a lot of the organizing yourself, is it helping to have such good support out there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we do have a good planning team to help us through these ventures. We wish we had a bigger planning team at this point.
Well, do you think that might change maybe with future events, that the more people here attend in July, see what it's all about, and when it's time to look for planning future Northwest Indiana Pride events, that it's going to pick up with the support as well as the helpers that will help make it possible?
We believe so. This is meant to be a community event, and we hope to bring together both members of the LGBTQ+ community as well as the community at large to see that we are no different from each other. We are all people who work and play in this area, Northwest Indiana, and that what we're doing is good for the community. We hope that we will have people coming to us and saying we'd like to help.
All our organizations build a thriving and robust LGBTQ and ally community in this area. And this area, I mean the 5-county region that Wikipedia defines Northwest Indiana to be, Lake, Porter, LaPorte, Newton, Jasper counties. And there will be many, many opportunities for volunteer work during the event. And we're hoping to build a good volunteer base as well that can help us throughout the year as we do other events.
Now, if anybody is interested in finding out more about this very first, what hopes to be a series of annual Northwest Indiana Pride events happening this year, happening at the Lincoln Community Center in Highland, where can people find out more? And if they'd like to get involved, even though you're through into the planning process already, where they can get a hold of you to show you their support?
I think the best way for people to see what's going on and contact us would be to go to our website, www.nwi-pride.org.
We're talking with Amari Victoria, who is the executive director of LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, and with Elizabeth Menning, who is the president of PFLAG Crown Point and also the CEO of Pride Events Incorporated. And they together and others in their team are helping put together the very first annual Northwest Indiana Pride event, which is going to be happening in July, on July 13th. And it's a one-day event that's going to be held at the Lincoln Community Center in Highland. And ladies, thank you for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you very much, Chris.
It's Eye on the Arts time, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Diana Bossa, who is the Special Events Administrator for the City of Crown Point. And Crown Point has lots of special events happening now at the new Bulldog Park, including the Sounds of Summer concert series. So, Diana, I understand that the series has launched and that you have 10 more concerts coming up this summer. How was your first concert?
Our first concert was great. So it was a kickoff. We had Dave Rudolph's British Reinvasion. So they were a great addition to the car cruise. It was really enjoyable for the crowd. The weather was a little chilly, so people were a little slow coming out, but as they heard the music going on and saw all the cars, we packed Bulldog Park. It was a great night.
So are all of the concerts going to be held during the car cruise nights?
No, they won't. They're going to vary during our Wednesday Farmers Market and also on Saturdays. There'll be some standalone concerts on Saturday evenings. So we just wanted to make sure we spread it out through different events so that it wasn't, every Saturday night, but it was an opportunity for some Saturday evenings, but also in conjunction with the car show and our Wednesday farmers market.
So could you just briefly describe the sort of amphitheater that has been built?
So the facility here at Bulldog Park is a $11 million project. It consists of a 16,000 square foot building that houses community rooms, skate rental for skating in the winter out under the pavilion. Mm-hmm. We have the parks and special events offices are here, so there's a variety of opportunities for the community to get involved in the programming that's going on here. We do senior programming during the day, so anybody can visit our website at crownpoint.in.gov to get a list of all the activities and things going on. They can also find a schedule of all the concerts. But Bulldog Park, again, it also is a 100 by 200 pavilion. In the winter, it has the hockey. Mm-hmm. In the summer, we have our festivals and events and things going on, as well as the amphitheater that will house all of the local bands. So it's quite an establishment. If you haven't been, you need to come out and see it.
And the next concert, for that matter, is on Saturday the 29th. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, we have Sounds of Santana that's joining us. It'll be from 7 to 10 on Saturday night. Concessions will be available. It's a family-friendly, fun event. We have, the amphitheater. We have a nice grass turf area where you can bring your chairs, you can bring blankets, you can just come and enjoy the atmosphere.
How many people can be accommodated at the amphitheater in the audience area?
We expect, couple thousand people.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. So,
yeah, I think it's definitely large enough to, with the pavilion and the grass area, to really, for people to really enjoy and really get a nice crowd. So mm-hmm. the bands will really get showcased at this facility.
Well, why don't you tell us about some of the other concerts that are coming up this summer after the June 29th date?
Okay, that sounds good. So on July 6th, we have Mr. Funny Man joining us. July 10th, the Hazard County Band. We have, in August, we have Switchback coming on August 3rd. August 7th, we have Mojo Morganfield and the Manish Boys. And then August 24th, Midnight Drive. So there's a variety of others that are also listed on our website. And a few dates might be changing, but those will be updated here shortly.
Well, it sounds like you did a lot of planning for this first season, because when did the amphitheater open?
We just opened on May 31st. We had our Bulldog Park grand opening that weekend, and it was a great success. And then last weekend as well, we had the Corn Roast hosted here. So we've jumped right in with both feet, and we've been busy ever since. So. Oh.
Well,
it's
that sounds great.
It's a great opportunity here.
Yeah, a great opportunity in many years to come, with lots of fun programming for people to enjoy.
Absolutely.
All right, Diana. Well, thank you for being on the air to tell us about it, and we look forward to hearing more in the future from you. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can get to this conversation and previous Eye on the Arts editions on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.